Chapter 34. A Different Dance. Ferlin burbled on as he showed them to their rooms, though Perrin did not really listen. He was too busy wondering if the black-haired girl knew what yellow eyes meant.
Burn me, she was looking at me.
Then he heard the innkeeper say the words, "Proclaiming the dragon in Giladan," and he thought his ears would go to sharp points like Loyal's. Moraine stopped dead in the doorway to her room.
"There is another false dragon, innkeeper, in Giladan?"
The hood of her cloak still hid her face, but she sounded shaken to her toes. Even listening for the man's reply, Perrin could not help staring at her. He smelled something close to fear.
"Ah, lady, never you fear. 'Tis 100 leagues to Giladan, and none will trouble you here. Not with Master Andra about, and Lord Orban and Lord Gunn. Why—"
"Answer her," Lan said harshly. "Is there a false dragon in Giladan?"
No, Master Andra, not precisely. I said there's a man proclaiming the dragon in Giladan. So we heard a few days gone. Preaching his coming, you might say. Talking about the fellow over in Taraban we've heard about, though some do say 'tis Arad-Duman, not Taraban. A long way from here in any case. Why, any other day I expect we'd talk more of that than anything else, except maybe the wild tales about Hawkwing's army come back."
Lan's cold eyes might as well have been knife blades from the way Ferlin swallowed and scrubbed his hands faster.
"I only know what I hear, Master Andra. 'Tis said the fellow has a stare can pin you where you stand, and he talks all sorts of rubbish about the dragon coming to save us, and we all have to follow, and even the beasts will fight for the dragon. I don't know whether they've arrested him yet or not. 'Tis likely. The Giladanin would not put up long with that kind of talk."
"Massima," Perrin thought wonderingly. "It's bloody Massima." "You are right, innkeeper," Lan said. "This fellow isn't likely to trouble us here. I know a fellow once who liked to make wild speeches. You remember him, Lady Alice, don't you? Massima?" Moraine gave a start.
"Massima. Yes, of course. I had put him out of my mind."
Her voice firmed.
"When next I see Massima, he will wish someone had peeled his hide to make boots."
She slammed the door behind her so hard that the crash echoed down the hallway.
"Keep it quiet," came a muffled shout from the far end. "My head is splitting."
"Ah!"
Ferlin washed his hands in one direction, then rubbed them in another.
"Ah, forgive me, Master Andra, but Lady Alice is a fierce-sounding woman."
"Only with those who displease her," Lan said blandly. "Her bite is far worse than her bark."
"Your rooms are this way. Friend Ogier, when Master Andra told me you were coming, I had an Ogier bed brought from the attic where it has been gathering dust these 300 years or more. Why, 'tis—"
Perrin let the words wash over him, hearing them no more than a river rock hears the water. The black-haired young woman worried him, and the caged Aiel. Once in his own room, a small one in the back, Lan had done nothing to disabuse the innkeeper of the notion that Perrin was a servant. He moved mechanically, still wrapped in thought. He unstrung his bow and propped it in the corner. Keeping it strung too long ruined bow and string alike. Set down his blanket roll and saddlebags beside the washstand, and threw his cloak across them. He hung his belts with quiver and axe from pegs on the wall, and nearly lay down on the bed before a jaw-cracking yawn reminded him how dangerous that might be. The bed was narrow, and the mattress appeared to be all lumps. It looked more inviting than any bed he could remember. He sat on the three-legged stool instead and thought. Always he liked to think things through. After a time, Loyal rapped on the door and put his head in. The Ogier's ears practically quivered with excitement, and his grin very nearly split his broad face in two.
"Perrin, you will not believe it. My bed is sungwood. Why, it must be well over 1,000 years old. No tree singer has sung a piece so large in at least that long. I myself would not care to try it. And I have the talent more strongly than most now. Well, to be truthful, there are not many of us with the talent at all any more. but I am among the best of those who can sing wood."
"That is very interesting," Perrin said.
"An Aiel in a cage. That is what Min said. Why was that girl staring at me?"
"I thought it was."
Loyal sounded a little put out that he did not share the Ogier's excitement, but all Perrin wanted to do was think.
"Supper is ready below, Perrin. They have prepared their finest in case the hunters want anything, but we can have some."
"You go on, Loyal. I'm not hungry." The smells of cooking meat floating up from the kitchen did not interest him. He hardly noticed Loyal going. Hands on his knees, yawning now and again, he tried to work it out. It seemed like one of those puzzles Master Luhan made, the metal pieces appearing to be linked inextricably. But there was always a trick to make the iron loops and whorls come apart, and there had to be here, too. The girl had been looking at him. His eyes might explain that, except that the innkeeper had ignored them, and no one else had even noticed. They had an Ogier to look at, and hunters of the horn in the house, and a lady visiting, and an Aiel caged in the square. Nothing as small as the color of a man's eyes could seize their attention. Nothing about a servant could compete with the rest.
So why did she pick me to stare at?
And the Aiel in the cage. What Min saw was always important, but how? What was he supposed to do? I could have stopped those children throwing rocks. I should have. It was no use telling himself the adults would certainly have told him to go on about his business, that he was a stranger in Remen, and the Aiel was none of his concern.
I should have tried.
No answers came to him, so he went back to the beginning and patiently worked through it once more. Then again, and again. Still he found nothing except regret for what he had not done. It came to him after a time that night had finally fallen. The room was dark except for a little moonlight through the lone window. He thought about the tallow candle in the tinderbox he had seen on the mantel over the narrow fireplace, but there was more than enough light for his eyes.
I have to do something, don't I?
He buckled on his axe, then paused. He had done it without thinking. Wearing the thing had become as natural as breathing. He did not like that. But he left the belt around his waist and went out. Light from the stairs made the hallway seem almost bright after his room. Talk and laughter drifted up from the common room and cooking smells from the kitchen. He strode toward the front of the inn, to Moraine's room, knocked once and went in, and stopped, his face burning. Moraine pulled the pale blue robe that hung from her shoulders around herself.
"You wish something?" she asked coolly.
She had a silver-backed hairbrush in one hand, and her dark hair, spilling down her neck in dark waves, glistened as if she had been brushing it. Her room was far finer than his, with polished wooden paneling on the walls and silver-chased lamps and a warm fire on the wide brick hearth. The air smelled of rose-scented soap.
I thought Lan was here," he managed to get out.
"You two always have your heads together, and I thought he'd... I thought..."
"What do you want, Perrin?"
He took a deep breath.
"Is this Rand's doing? I know Lan followed him here, and it all seems odd, the hunters and Aiel. But did he do it?"
"I do not think so. I will know more when Lan tells me what he discovers tonight. With luck, what he finds will help the choice I must make."
"A choice?"
"Rand could have crossed the river and be on his way to Tyr cross-country. Or he could have taken ship downriver to Ilion, meaning to board another there for Tyr. The journey is leagues longer that way, but days faster."
"I don't think we are going to catch him, Moraine. I don't know how he's doing it, but even afoot he is staying ahead of us. If Lan is right, he is still half a day ahead."
"I could almost suspect he had learned to travel," Moraine said with a small frown. "Except that if he had, he would have gone straight to Tyr. No, he has the blood of long walkers and strong runners in him. But we may take the river anyway. If I cannot catch him, I will be in Tyr close behind him, or waiting for him."
Perrin shifted his feet uneasily. There was cold promise in her voice.
"You told me once that you could sense a dark friend,
one who has far gone into the shadow, at least. Lan, too. Have you sensed anything like that here?
She gave a loud sniff and turned back to a tall standing mirror with finely made silver work set in the legs. Holding a robe closed with one hand, she ran the brush through her hair with the other.
Very few humans are so far gone as that, Perrin. Even among the worst dark friends.
The brush halted in mid-stroke.
Why do you ask?
There was a girl down in the common room staring at me. Not at you and Loyal like everybody else. At me.
The brush resumed motion, and a smile briefly touched Moraine's lips. You sometimes forget, Perrin, that you are a good-looking young man. Some girls admire a pair of shoulders.
He grunted and shuffled his feet.
Was there something else, Perrin?
No. She could not help with Min's viewing, not beyond telling him what he already knew, that it was important. And he did not want to tell her what Min had seen, or that Min had seen anything, for that matter. Back out in the hall, with the door closed, he leaned against the wall for a moment.
Light, just walking in on her like that, and her...
She was a pretty woman.
And likely old enough to be my mother or more.
He thought Matt would probably have asked her down to the common room to dance.
No, he wouldn't. Even Matt isn't fool enough to try charming an Aes Sedai.
Moraine did dance. He had danced with her once himself, and nearly fallen over his own feet with every other step.
Stop thinking about her like a village girl just because you saw... She's bloody Aes Sedai. You have that Aiel to worry about.
He gave himself a shake and went downstairs. The common room was full as it could be, with every chair taken and stools and benches brought in, and those who had nowhere to sit standing along the walls. He did not see the black-haired girl, and no one else looked at him twice as he hurriedly crossed the room. Orban occupied a table to himself, his bandaged leg propped up on a chair with a cushion, with a soft slipper on that foot, a silver goblet in his hand, the serving women keeping it filled with wine.
"Aye," he was saying to the whole room, "we knew the Aiel for fierce fighters, Gon and I, but there was no time to hesitate. I drew my sword and dug my heels into lion's ribs."
Perrin gave a start before he realized that the man meant his horse was named Lion.
Wouldn't put it past him to say he was riding a lion.
He felt a bit ashamed. Just because he did not like the man was no reason to suppose the hunter would take his boasting that far. He hurried on outside without looking back. The street in front of the inn was as crowded as inside, with people who could not find a place in the common room peering in through the windows, and twice as many huddling around the doors to listen to Orban's tale. No one glanced at Perrin twice, though his passage brought muttered complaints from those jostled a little further from the door. Everyone who was out in the night must have been at the inn, for he saw no one as he walked to the square. Sometimes the shadow of a person moved across a lighted window, but that was all. He had the feeling of being watched, though, and looked around uneasily. Nothing but night-cloaked streets dotted with glowing windows. Around the square, most of the windows were dark, except a few on upper floors. The gibbet stood as he remembered, the man, the Aiel, still in the cage, hanging higher than he could reach. The Aiel seemed to be awake, at least his head was up, but he never looked down at Perrin. The stones the children had been throwing were scattered beneath the cage. The cage hung from a thick rope, tied to a ring on one of the upper bars, and running through a heavy pulley on the crosspiece down to a pair of stubs waist high from the bottom of the upright on either side. The excess rope lay in a careless tangle of coils at the foot of the gibbet. Perrin looked around again, searching the dark square. He still had the feeling of being watched, but he still saw nothing. He listened and heard nothing. He smelled chimney smoke and cooking from the houses, and man sweat and the old blood from the man in the cage. There was no fear scent from him. His weight, and then there's the cage, he thought as he moved closer to the gibbet. He did not know when he had decided to do this, or even if he really had decided, but he knew he was going to do it. Hooking a leg around the heavy upright, he heaved on the rope, hoisting the cage enough to gain a little slack.
The way the rope jerked told him the man in the cage had finally moved, but he was in too much of a hurry to stop and tell him what he was doing. The slack let him unwind the rope from around the stubs. Still bracing himself with his leg around the upright, he quickly lowered the cage hand over hand to the paving blocks. The Aiel was looking at him now, studying him silently. Perrin said nothing. When he got a good look at the cage, his mouth tightened. If a thing was made, even a thing like this, it should be made well. The entire front of the cage was a door, on rude hinges, made by a hasty hand, held by a good iron lock on a chain as badly wrought as the cage. He fumbled the chain around until he found the worst link, then jammed the thick spike on his axe through it. A sharp twist of his wrist forced the link open. In seconds, he separated the chain, rattled it free, and swung open the front of the cage. The Aiel sat there, knees yet under his chin, staring at him.
"Well," Perrin whispered hoarsely, "I opened it, but I'm not going to bloody carry you."
He looked hastily around the night-dark square. Still nothing moved, but he still had the feel of eyes watching.
"You are strong, Wetlander."
The Aiel did not move beyond working his shoulders.
"It took 3 men to hoist me up there. And now you bring me down. Why?"
"I don't like seeing people in cages," Perrin whispered. He wanted to go. The cage was open and those eyes were watching. But the Aiel was not moving.
"If you do a thing, do it right. Will you get out of there before somebody comes?"
The Aiel grasped the frontmost overhead bar of the cage, heaved himself out and to his feet in one motion, then half hung there, supporting himself with his grip on the bar. He would have been nearly a head taller than Perrin, standing straight. He glanced at Perrin's eyes. Perrin knew how they must shine, burnished gold in the moonlight. But he did not mention them.
"I have been in there since yesterday, Wetlander."
He sounded like Lan. Not that their voices or accents were anything alike, but the Aiel had that same unruffled coolness, that same calm sureness.
"It will take a moment for my legs to work. I am Gaul of the Imran Sept of the Sharad Aiel, Wetlander. I am Shayan Emtal, a stone dog. My water is yours.
Well, I am Perrin Ebarra of the Two Rivers. I am a blacksmith."
The man was out of the cage. He could go now. Only if anyone came along before Gaul could walk, he would be right back into the cage unless they killed him, and either way would waste Perrin's work.
"If I had thought, I'd have brought a water bottle or a skin. Why do you call me Wetlander?"
Gaul gestured toward the river. Even Perrin's eyes could not be sure in the moonlight. But he thought the Aiel looked uneasy for the first time.
3 days ago, I watched a girl sporting in a huge pool of water. It must have been 20 paces across. She pulled herself out into it."
He made an awkward swimming gesture with one hand.
"A brave girl, crossing these rivers, has nearly unmanned me. I never thought there could be such a thing as too much water, but I never thought there was so much water in the world as you Wetlanders have."
Perrin shook his head. He knew the Aiel waste held little water. It was one of the few things he knew about the waste or the Aiel. But he had not thought it could be scarce enough to cause this reaction.
"You're a long way from home, Gaul. Why are you here?"
"We search," Gaul said slowly. "We look for he who comes with the dawn."
Perrin had heard that name before, under circumstances that made him sure who it meant.
"Light, it always comes back to Rand. I am tied to him like a mean horse for shoeing."
"You are looking in the wrong direction, Gaul. I am looking for him too, and he is on his way to Tyr."
"Tyr?"
The Aiel sounded surprised.
"Why?" "But it must be. Prophecy says when the stone of Tyr falls, we will leave the threefold land at last."
That was the Aiel name for the waste.
"It says we will be changed and find again what was ours and was lost."
"That may be.
I don't know your prophecies, Gull. Are you about ready to leave? Somebody could come any minute. It is too late to run, Gull said. And a deep voice shouted, The savage is loose! 10 or 12 white-cloaked men came running across the square, drawing swords, their conical helmets shining in the moonlight. Children of the Light. As if he had all the time in the world, Gull calmly lifted a dark cloth from his shoulders and wrapped it around his head, finishing with a thick black veil that hid his face except for his eyes. Do you like to dance, Perrin Ebarra? He asked. With that, he darted away from the cage, straight at the oncoming white cloaks. For an instant, they were caught by surprise, but an instant was apparently all the Aiel needed. He kicked the sword out of the grip of the first to reach him, then his stiffened hand struck like a dagger at the white cloak's throat, and he slid around the soldier as he fell. The next man's arm made a loud snap as Gull broke it. He pushed that man under the feet of a third and kicked the fourth in the face. It was like a dance, from one to the next without stopping or slowing, though the tripped fellow was climbing back to his feet and the one with the broken arm had shifted his sword. Gull danced on in the midst of them. Perrin had only an amazed moment himself, for not all the white cloaks had put their attentions on the Aiel. Barely in time, he gripped the axe haft with both hands to block a sword thrust, swung, and wanted to cry out as the half-moon blade tore the man's throat. But he had no time for crying out, none for regrets. More white cloaks followed before the first fell. He hated the gaping wounds the axe made, hated the way it chopped through mail to rend flesh beneath, split helmet and skull with almost equal ease. He hated it all. But he did not want to die. Time seemed to compress and stretch out, both at once. His body felt as if he fought for hours, and breath rasped raw in his throat. Men seemed to move as though floating through jelly. They seemed to leap in an instant from where they started to where they fell. Sweat rolled down his face, yet he felt as cold as quenching water. He fought for his life, and he could not have said whether it lasted seconds or all night. When he finally stood, panting and nearly stunned, looking at 12 white-cloaked men lying on the paving blocks of the square, the moon appeared not to have moved at all. Some of the men groaned, others lay silent and still. Gull stood among them, still veiled, still empty-handed. Most of the men down were his work. Perrin wished they all were and felt ashamed. The smell of blood and death was sharp and bitter. You do not dance the spears badly, Perrin Ebarra. Head spinning, Perrin muttered. I don't see how 12 men fought 20 of you and one, even if 2 of them are hunters. Is that what they say? Gull laughed softly. Sarien and I were careless, being so long in these soft lands, and the wind was from the wrong direction, so we smelled nothing. We walked into them before we knew it. Well, Sarien is dead, and I was caged like a fool, so perhaps we paid enough. It is time for running now, Wetlander. Tyr. I will remember it. At last he lowered the black veil. May you always find water and shade, Perrin Ebarra. Turning, he ran into the night. Perrin started to run, too, then realized he had a bloody axe in his hands. Hastily, he wiped the curved blade on a dead man's cloak. He's dead, burn me, and there's blood on it already. He made himself put the haft back through the loop on his belt before he broke into a trot. At his second step, he saw her, a slim shape at the edge of the square in dark, narrow skirts. She turned to run. He could see they were divided for riding. She darted back into the street and vanished. Lan met him before he reached the place where she had been standing. The warder took in the cage sitting empty beneath the gibbet, the shadowed white mounds that caught the moonlight, and he tossed his head as if he were about to erupt. In a voice as tight and hard as a new wheel rim, he said, Is this your work, blacksmith? The light burned me. Is there anyone who can connect it to you? A girl, Perrin said. I think she saw. I don't want you to hurt her, Lan. Plenty of others could have seen, too. There are lighted windows all around. The warder grabbed Perrin's coat sleeve and gave him a push toward the inn. I saw a girl running, but I thought, no matter. You dig the Ogier out and haul him down to the stable. After this, we need to get our horses to the docks as quickly as possible. The light alone knows if there is a ship sailing tonight, or what I'll have to pay to hire one if there isn't. Don't ask questions, blacksmith. Do it. Run!